It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Let us join in an attitude of prayer. We pray that we can find a way to fit all our parts together into a coordinated whole, an integrated and coordinated soul. We are such complex creatures. We have so many parts, so many voices inside telling us what we should do or be. One says, work harder, earn more, provide for your family. Another says, spend more time with your family, your partner, your friends. One voice says, obey authorities, serve your nation. Another says, question your leaders to ensure that they are serving your nation. One voice wants us to get to know ourselves better, to go deeper into who we are and who we should be. Another voice urges us to be sociable, to look outward rather than inward, to become active parts of a larger world than just ourselves. Socrates once said, the unexamined life is not worth living, and we still try to examine, to know ourselves, to know our souls. But the unlived life is not worth examining. And so we are pulled outward again to spend time and energy experiencing rather than contemplating. And there are many more voices than these. We each have our own personal pantheon of gods giving us orders as we struggle to pull them all together into a whole. Our quest is for nothing less than the lost Atlantis of the coordinated soul. It is the quest that makes us most fully human and most nuanced. We pray for the insight, the vision, and the will to listen to the best voices and learn to blend them together. It is a noble goal. Let us persist. And let us be patient with ourselves. Amen. This is the third sermon I've done on the Greek gods and goddesses, and it's such a rich field that I've been led to places I hadn't expected each time. This morning is the first of two on the Greek gods. We had two sermons on the goddesses earlier. And the second part of this will be in 2 weeks, on January 30th. I'll be in Florida next week. Jesus and I are going to Florida. I'm doing a Jesus seminar program in Pensacola for a while. It's not, Jesus and I aren't quite going to Florida. This business of gods is complex. And one thing I realized this time looking at the gods is what I missed looking at the goddesses. When we talked about the Greek goddesses, I was using them to see archetypes, psychological archetypes, styles that women today still see in themselves that seem to be part of human nature, at least in Western culture. What I didn't think of last time was that we could just as well have used the Greek goddesses to look at the kinds of institutions that women largely define, because we find the same goddesses present in families, in public school education, and in nursing.
areas where women have had defining roles. And so you find more feminine values there, concerned more with relationships, with nurturing, with a kind of justice that treats everyone the same just because they're people, and so on. When we study the male gods, especially the Greek ones, we have to talk about how they define the areas of the world that men run, because it's most areas of the world. So the male gods can show us not only voices within ourselves as men, but can show us a profile of the world we're living in. See if you don't agree as we go on. First, if we're going to talk about the Greek gods, though, every time I talk about gods, I have to do this. We have to take some time, again, to understand what gods are. Different cultures have produced very different gods. There are ways in which it's all kind of like the old Hindu story of the blind man and the elephant. It takes all the gods you can find to have a fairly adequate picture of the world and of human nature. But they're very different kinds of gods. Ancient Indian culture, in their Brahman, produced probably the most abstract and biggest god of all. Brahman isn't even pictured. It's the abstract principle of all the forces that create, sustain, and destroy in the whole universe. That's fairly large. Very abstract. Yahweh, the main god of the Hebrew scriptures, what Christians love patronizingly to call the Old Testament, Yahweh was very different. Yahweh was created in the image of a local tribal chief. Biblical scholars have been saying this for decades. So Yahweh, like a tribal chief, sets the rules for behavior, promises to reward the obedient and to punish the disobedient, just like a tribal chief would. Biblical scholars have found that the covenant between that God and his chosen people was modeled precisely on ancient Hittite treaties between a sovereign and his subjects. So it's a very different kind of God than Brahman is in Hinduism. Yahweh told us what we could and couldn't do. He had a lot of sexual hang-ups. Well, I compare him to the Hindu gods, for goodness sake. He had a lot of sexual hang-ups, and those who spoke for Yahweh were always writing commandments that they insisted this God wanted us to follow. They still do that, you notice. Now, the Greek gods were quite different from both these. For one thing, they could hardly forbid many behaviors because they pretty much did them all themselves. They were certainly more comfortable with sex than old Yahweh was. The Greek gods were made as imaginative images of the psychological dynamics the Greeks saw within human nature. Remember, the word psyche is a Greek word. It means soul. Psychology was supposed to be the study of the soul. So while the ancient Greek gods aren't worshipped anymore, there are ways in which they're still alive and still relevant because they're about us. They're about a human nature that hasn't changed much in thousands of years. Now, you could spend years just on the four gods I want to talk about today. I'll talk about four other gods next time. These gods are about men, but since men control the power of states, armies, and most organized religions, they also show us a picture of our world, a picture of Western civilization that has half its roots deep into the soil of the ancient Greeks. We hear a lot in the media about how some of the roots of America are in the biblical traditions, and that's true. But our intellectual, our scientific traditions all have their roots in Greece. All of our spaceships are named for Greek gods, not biblical characters. They didn't take Goliath to the moon, they took Apollo. Okay, Goliath probably isn't the one they would have chosen to go to the moon. He didn't come out too well. One more word about gods, since it's a hard subject to understand what gods are. The study of gods is not like a manhunt or a search for a missing person. There are no fellows, no critters, no big guys in the sky or up a mountain that we're planning to find, then sit down and chat with. That's not what gods are. The discovery of gods is the discovery of the human soul in some of its most powerful and imaginative manifestations. We create our gods to preserve and teach our visions of what the world is fundamentally like, what we're fundamentally like, and who she would be, who we should be, who she would be. Man. Hermes isn't with me today. I need Hermes. So this is a discovery of the human soul. And that's really a Theology 101 course in one paragraph. So we'll take 2 weeks for Greek male gods. We'll talk about four today and four more in 2 weeks. While most of the gods are psychological archetypes of styles we men can still find in ourselves, especially the gods in 2 weeks, the three most powerful Greek gods are in a category all their own. They are about quite profound psychological insights into styles of being that apply equally, I think, to both men and women. We'll all identify with the three main Greek gods. So I want to begin with those three gods who were brothers, and I want to back into it imaginatively. Think of our world as having three different levels, three different realms, three different styles of living and being. The first level emphasizes clear thinking, cool, impersonal rationality. It takes the long view. It sets goals. It works to achieve them. It controls everything. You could think of bright sunlight on a clear day for this kind of a vision and this kind of a realm. The job of the god in this realm is to harness all of our different gods into an integrated and productive whole. That's why it's the most important of all the Greek gods. Now, the second level is as deep as the ocean and often as turbulent, very different from the first. Here it is not clear thinking that rules, but powerful emotions, terrifyingly powerful emotions. There is no long view. There's no overall plan, though both desire and rage may last a long time, and a grudge can be carried forever. There are deep feelings here that would frighten most people and that most of us just avoid. But to those who live in this realm, the deep and powerful feelings are home. However, they're not very often a comfortable home. Their turbulence short circuits nearly all efforts to put a life in order, and you're tossed about on the waves of an overwhelming sea of powerful feelings. The third realm, we'll come back to all these, is in the underworld. It's cool, it's dark, it's not emotionally powerful. It's removed from the worlds of both the first two levels. Few people want to go there either. It's the realm of the suppressed and the unconscious, of convoluted ambiguities, shadow sides, dark doubts. This is the underside of the first world. It's the underside of the bright and clear world, where things are neither bright nor clear, though real. It's its other half. It's always beneath us, this underworld. Though few can live in it and few would want to. You could call this third level the realm of Hades. That's what the Greeks called it. Or you could call it hell, after the Norse goddess of the underworld. The Greek mythology is just wonderful here and so telling, because they said Hades was almost never seen, though he was always there. Hades had a cap of invisibility, making him an unseen presence. Now, how modern does this sound? Today, our psychologists have shown us that the realm of the unconscious and the shadow sides and the suppressed parts of our psyches are an unseen presence within our lives and our world all the time. The Greeks knew that over 3,000 years ago. Hades people can often be found leading lives of quiet desperation, aware of the shadow sides, but unable to integrate them into a well-ordered life. And that second level, that level of living where deep and turbulent emotions rule, you can think of as the realm of Poseidon, a brother of Hades. Like Hades, his was the realm of inner realities rather than outer ones. But here they have a terrible force. They carry grudges. They seek vengeance. And like the sea, they often have a calm surface hiding a raging fury beneath. All of us have felt this at some time or other. But it would be awful to be ruled by this. This needs something else to coordinate it, or we're in trouble. To take some violent examples, think of the number of times, these are Poseidon people, think of the number of times that we have heard mass murderers described as calm, quiet people. The surface was not like the depths. The depths were furious. And those of you who've spent time studying the Greek classics will know of the awful power and rage that Poseidon had. It's almost all he had. The whole book of the Odyssey, Odysseus's entire 10-year Odyssey, was driven by Poseidon's fury. Poseidon chased Odysseus for 10 years out of fury because Odysseus had killed his son, Polyphemus, the Cyclops. Odysseus would never have made it home if it hadn't been for Athena, who was always willing to help male heroes in Greek. Neither Hades nor Poseidon ever accomplished much that was constructive. Poseidon was as much a victim of his fury as everyone else was, because he could not escape its pull on him. So Poseidon remained mostly trapped within the depths of his feelings, as Hades remained mostly in the dark depths of shadows and abstractions and too much sensitivity. Both ancient myths and modern experience say that few people would want to live in either one of these places. And those who do are not people that you want to invite to parties. Both in Greek mythology and in our Western cultures, which have been so heavily shaped by Greek mythology, these aren't the things that we prize. We choose to live above the ground, in consciousness, in sunlight, in clear, rational thought. And that first level, that realm of clarity and light and rationality, was the realm of Zeus, the number one god of the Olympian pantheon. Zeus's job, when he wasn't cavorting around after women, was to coordinate our passions and our other voices, all the gods, into a working and integrated whole. This isn't the way other gods work. This isn't what Yahweh did. Yahweh tried to suppress or deny troubling passions, certainly sexual passions, and it's infected all of Western civilization with that bias. Gods are powerful things. I was struck several times while working on this sermon just how much our world today really does echo the old priorities of the Greek gods. The world that they and we recognize as normative, healthy, and sane is the realm of Zeus's clear thinking. Rational behavior, a life where dark doubts and powerful emotions are kept in line through the training and education of unclouded, well-ordered minds. This sounds as modern as you can get, and every Greek would have recognized it as the ideal. As individuals and as a society, we're not comfortable with introspection or deep doubts. And since we insist that everything lies on the surface, knowing what to do is just a matter of gathering the necessary facts and taking action. This is the style of life that the Greeks exalted in their myths and that Western cultures exalted for 3,000 years. It's also the style that all the Greek tragedians and poets made fun of and attacked as inadequate. Zeus was the god of lightning. I've loved that. You don't think the gods are alive? His symbol was the thunderbolt. To this day, when we go against an authoritative voice, we still speak of waiting for the lightning to strike. Gods are hard to kill. These first three gods, Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades, the brothers, show us the major parts of our psyches. This is men and women. We can all identify with these. But now I want to go back to that alpha male, the main man, the top god, Zeus, and his number one son. Now we're getting into a god that is a male god and is about men. Zeus was like the CEO of the Olympic deities, or at least he tried to be when he wasn't cavorting. And in our own culture, CEO types operate much like Zeus. They give the orders, they have the vision, their anger can make heads roll, you wait for the lightning to strike there too. But they need subordinate people to get the job done. Competent, brilliant subordinate people to get the job done. Not the ambitious kind who'll be fighting them for control. CEOs don't look for people who want their job. The auxiliary kind, the highest level of functionary, who work toward the goals the leader has set with the same kind of clear thinking and dispassionate genius that the leader has. I think of general's aides or presidential press secretaries, public spokesmen whose job and whose talent is to diffuse or redirect all criticism of the boss, to dismiss doubts, to look only on the optimistic side of things, to be can-do men who act like the favorite sons of their leader, their father. These are the people in the mold of the god Apollo, one of the most intriguing of all the Greek gods, especially for men. You could say he was the second most important god to the Greeks. Apollo was a very strange person. Other people say of Apollo-type people, and it's surprising how many people describe Apollo-type people in very unflattering ways. Other people say of these people that they are emotionally distant, that they have little real personal passion. Their ex-wives say they were lousy lovers, technical and impersonal, that they can't express feelings and don't care to get into the murky depths where doubts live or into the shadow sides of their bright optimism. Others may say that their focus and their clear vision are achieved at the cost of being stunted in other areas. And while they attract admiration, respect, maybe even envy, these people seldom inspire love or even passion. They're clear-sighted and far-seeing, like eagles flying high above it all, and will often sacrifice their children, their partner, their friends, and their personal lives to get power, to help consolidate it, and to keep in the favor of daddy. While people admire or fear Apollo types, they seldom love them. And the Greeks noticed this too. And you can see it in the stories they told about Apollo. They're really fascinating stories. Now, you would think that if you're a god, a male god now I'm talking, and you want a woman, You're a god. What's the problem? Well, this wasn't the case with Apollo. Women didn't like him. Amazing? I mean, you'd think if you're a god, that's even better than being like a rap singer or a pro athlete. But not if you're Apollo. One of the most famous stories about Apollo shows how much women didn't like him. It's the story of Cassandra, one of my favorite characters in all Greek mythology. Apollo was trying to seduce Cassandra, who was not interested. So he tried to bribe her by giving her an amazing gift. The gift he gave Cassandra was the gift of being able to see clearly into the future when no one else could, to know what was going to happen in the future. It's amazing. She accepted the gift, and then he tried again with her, but she wasn't interested. She liked the gift, but not the giver. Apollo couldn't take back the gift. This must have been some kind of a rule of godly etiquette. And so he added a strange curse to it, which is what gave Cassandra her famous character. And the curse he gave Cassandra was that while she could always see into the future, because he'd given her that gift and he couldn't take it back, and she could always tell people what was going to happen, and she would always be right, no one would ever believe her. So Cassandra foretold the coming of the Trojan War, and no one would believe her. Fascinating story. But it was a gift given to her by a god to whom women were not attracted. We train these Apollo people in our schools, don't we? Where clear thinking and dispassionate rationality are prized, where knowledge is quantified, and those who best learn the rules and have the self-control needed to play the game are the ones who win, get the best grades, earn the respect of their classmates, maybe not their love, but their respect, win scholarships, go to college, are class presidents, and they keep shining. No wonder Apollo is a solar deity. There's light all around him. In fact, the most common image of the good life held out for children by their parents may be this image of an efficient, orderly, and successful life where both doubts and passions are controlled so that they can't sabotage our long-range plans. Doesn't this sound American? It's no surprise that Zeus's symbolic creature was the eagle, for that far-sighted and dispassionate view is still the ideal in our world. It's still what our education trains us for. It's still the path that leads to success in business and politics. It's also reflected in Freud's psychology, where sanity and health are achieved when the rational ego, the Zeus, can control and organize the passionate and potentially destructive forces of our id, like a well-trained rider controlling the more powerful but more primitive horse that he rides. What we consider both reality and sanity are models of this kind of rational control, of delayed gratification, of working together, following the legitimate authority passed down from above. It's the world of modern commerce and competitive markets, where only the most efficient and far-seeing will survive, and the others will be dictated to by those at the top. Ancient Greeks would recognize this immediately. It's stunning that we do too. Our dominant American myths are bound up with this picture of being number one, being on top, controlling the weapons, controlling industry, having the most clout. But there's a human dimension that is absolutely lacking in Apollo. And the Greeks saw it. Where's the warmth? Where's the compassion of lives lived this way? That's why women weren't attracted to Apollo. Maybe we could admire or fear the kind of impersonal or objective power that our Apollos and our American leaders emulating Apollo are modeling. But could anyone love it? Something's missing. And what's missing, the Greeks would know, is essential if we're going to become complete human beings or a healthy society. The goal, both 3,000 years ago and now, was never to be the most powerful, angry, or warlike. These were the gods that were minor gods. We'll talk next time about the irrational gods that Zeus threw out. The goal was never to be taken over by power and arrogance and anger. The goal was always learning to become a whole person or a healthy and just society. That's what the Greek gods were created for. They were created to give people models of who they should be and how the world should run. That's what they were created for. Homer is credited with doing this after Greece came out of its dark ages, and they had no models. They had no notion of how men and women should be, how society should run. And Homer is given credit for putting together the pantheon of gods that spelled out who we should be and how we should live. That's their job. When people are out of balance, it's usually because the wrong gods are running the show. The wrong gods are running the show when a society is out of balance, too. Joseph Campbell was the one who once said the task of modern people is the quest for the lost Atlantis of the coordinated soul. It's also the quest for the lost Atlantis of the coordinated and humane society. See how modern all the Greek gods seem suddenly?